Thank you very much, Graham, for your kind introduction. This is going to be rather less symphonic than you might be accustomed to in this particular room. I'd like to thank the organisers for the invitation to come to Hobart in winter. It's in fact a bit warmer here this morning than it is in Sydney, I'm told. So good to be here. It's particularly good to be here because this year, 2014, marks the centenary of economics at the University of Tasmania, dating from the time that Herbert Heaton took up duties as a lecturer here. I gather that his pacifist and somewhat left-leaning views apparently caused some controversy here in Hobart and subsequently at the University of Adelaide, and he left Australia in 1925 for Canada and later had a successful career at the University of Minnesota. Interesting start to economics here in Tasmania, but over the ensuing period, and this is the interesting part, some of the greatest names in Australian economics have either studied here, taught here, or both, or in some other respect carried out some of their professional duties here. It's quite a lineup. There was L.F. Giblin, born here in Tasmania, son of a premier, sportsman, Cambridge student, acquaintance of the Bloomsbury set, enlisted in middle age for the First World War, was wounded three times, subsequently became government statistician in Tasmania and, of course, a very influential advisor nationally during the 1930s. There were those labelled Giblin's Platoon in the very nice book of that name by Will Coleman, Selwyn Cornish and Alf Hager. Douglas Copeland, lecturer here, first dean of the faculty here, subsequently at University of Melbourne, the original author of the Premier's Plan in the 1930s, diplomat, vice-chancellor of the ANU and so on. James Brigden, like Giblin, a soldier, also wounded, a lecturer here in Tasmania in economics, went on to many other important posts and very influential in policy circles on tariffs and wages. Sir Roland Wilson, also born in Tasmania, studied here, taught here, later Commonwealth statistician, diplomat, chairman of many important bodies, and of course the longest serving Secretary to the Australian Treasury. And the book by Coleman and his co-authors chronicles the way in which the relationships between these men, and it was men then, bore fruit. It was a remarkable period for activity in the economics profession in Australia, and people who were intimately involved in all that were in some way associated with the University of Tasmania. So you could argue, I think, that in some respects, a good deal of the genesis of modern policy economics in Australia actually germinated here in Hobart. Interesting to think back to that generation. All generations have their challenges. They had certainly major challenges. In the careers of today's generation, we've had the great inflation, so-called, the great moderation, the great recession. The ensuing slow recovery in the advanced countries could, I think, be described as the great disappointment, though one commentator has used rather stronger language, describing it rather biblically as the great tribulation. Well, maybe there's an undue devaluation of the adjective great in all of that. Or maybe not. Certainly Giblin's generation here in Tasmania faced enormous challenges. But plenty of writers, including some who've been intimately involved in policy in the past 5 or 6 years, have seen the recent episode as potentially as catastrophic as the 1930s. Averted only because of interventions that were framed with the lessons of the 1930s in mind. I find all that stuff very interesting, but today I'm not going to talk any more about that. I'm going to do something rather less ambitious. We published our latest statement on monetary policy in early May. Since then, we've had a couple more rate decisions. We've had the budget, some more data. And so what I propose to do is to talk about an economic update for the remainder of my time. It appears that the economy's pace of growth increased a bit over the second half of last year, and that that's persisted into early 2014. Real GDP expanded at an annualised pace of about 3% in the second half of last year. That was up a little from around 2.5% in the first half. Business survey readings are broadly consistent with that picture. The March quarter of this year in the national accounts saw a further pickup to something that was above trend, measured either quarterly or annually. Now, a key question there is the extent to which those recent data in the national accounts in particular illustrate the likely ongoing pace of growth from here. That particular result, that quarter, certainly owed a lot to a very large rise in resource exports. In a way, it's not surprising that that happens because, as you know, we've had this very big increase in capacity in the resource sector, and some of that is now coming on stream. There was also unusually benign weather, which was less disruptive to shipments than it often is at this time of year, so in a seasonally adjusted sense, that that gave a bit of a gain as well. Now, we expect further rises in resource export volumes to occur, but not that quickly, not at that pace, over the period ahead. And so, in our view, the most recent set of GDP data, certainly very encouraging, probably a little bit better than had been expected some months ago, but they probably overstate, to some extent, the true ongoing pace of growth in the economy. Our forecast from early May, which we haven't materially changed at this point, are for further growth in the economy over the period ahead, but probably at a bit below trend pace over the rest of the year. We'll provide an update of those forecasts early next month with the next SMP. Let me talk then a little bit about what the features are of, only some of the features, but some of the important ones in that outlook. Well, the first is the world economy, which I think continues to grow at a moderate pace, probably a little bit below its average pace, though not that much below, and with some prospect of a pickup. The advanced countries are seeing better conditions, better growth this year than last year, weather effects in the US in the first quarter aside, while some emerging countries, including China, slowed during the first half of this year. But overall, the world economy is growing at a moderate pace. Looking at domestic policy settings, the stance of monetary policy clearly is very accommodative, certainly when we measure it by the level of interest rates. Rate levels, including for borrowers, are at 50-year lows. The cash rate in real terms is about zero. In either nominal or real terms, it's well below normal levels and comfortably below even the mooted new normal levels, of which are thought to be lower by many people than the old normal. Moreover, we still have ammunition on interest rates. We haven't got close to the lower bound that has afflicted some other countries. These low rates are doing many of the things you'd normally expect that they do. Savers have altered their behaviour and they're looking for higher returns in some other assets that have somewhat higher risk. Asset prices have risen. Demand for credit has strengthened somewhat. And interest-sensitive areas of spending, including some parts of consumption, but especially dwelling construction, have firmed. The exchange rate also declined, though, as you know, not by as much as you might have expected based on past relationships. At least not so far. I think the full effects of the very accommodative stance of policy haven't been seen yet, and this policy stance will be supporting demand for quite some time ahead. Turning to the budget, I think this is unlikely to materially change the near-term outlook for the economy. Over the next couple of years, there's certainly fiscal consolidation, but not very different in amount from what we'd already been assuming. and the amount of consolidation is actually not particularly large in comparison to other periods of fiscal consolidation in the past. Beyond that period, beyond the next year or two, the measures in the budget will result at that point in a more significant consolidation than had been assumed earlier. And I think that's sensible because it was over that medium-term horizon that the Commonwealth's finances, had they been left unattended, looked like they were going to start going more materially off course. So the intended timing of the consolidation, not really any more than previously assumed now, but more later, that makes sense. Now, having said that, the fact that the real issues with public finances are medium-term ones isn't a reason to put off taking decisions to address them. On the contrary, as we can see from the experience of so many other countries, by the time those sorts of problems go from being on the horizon to being on the doorstep, they've usually become much more difficult to deal with. So early, measured actions that have effects that build up over time is a much better approach than the much tougher responses that might be and probably would be required if decisions were delayed. Now, there's been some discussion about confidence effects of the budget, and certainly there are some surveys that suggest some decline in household confidence of late. It was actually declining a little before the budget, but took another leg down subsequently. I think it's important to ask, though, how persistent such effects might be. If you look back to last year's budget, that also contained some tough messaging, and there was a decline in confidence measures subsequently. After a few months, they recovered. So we can't know whether that pattern will be repeated this year or not. We can only wait to see. Certainly measures of business confidence at this point show no obvious response to the budget at all. So while there's been a lot of focus on budget measures lately, I still think that the biggest sources of uncertainty about the pace of private demand growth in the economy remains the speed of the impending large decline in capital spending by the resources sector, and that's begun, but it has a long time to go yet. And on the other hand, the timing of the recovery in non-mining capital spending and non-mining activity more generally. The biggest and most persistent terms of trade gain in at least a century ushered in a capital spending response by mining and energy companies that saw the private business investment share of GDP reach a 50-year high, even though investment outside of mining approached near-recession lows. Now the terms of trade are falling, and the investment part of the boom has peaked. Mining investment as a share of GDP has probably already fallen by about 1 percentage point, and it will fall by another 3 or 4 percentage points over the next few years. Now, unlike in all previous such booms, we didn't experience serious overheating in the upswing. What's being attempted now is to negotiate the downswing phase without the slump that accompanied every previous boom and bust of this type. And if you want the history of that, there's a very good speech a few years ago by Rick Battaglino that went through the long and, in most respects, rather troubling history of these commodity price cycles in the past. Now, the fact that we managed the upswing without most of the excesses that had accompanied previous such upswings, well, that's no guarantee that we managed the down phase effectively, but at least it's a good starting point. We have, I think, seen some encouraging early signs of the so-called rebalancing in the economy taking place. Consumer demand has been rising moderately, though most recently I think probably a little more slowly than the very strong pace of growth over the summer. Residential construction is moving up strongly. Intentions to invest outside of the resources sector have started to improve, admittedly from very subdued levels. And the labour market has shown some early indications of mild improvement. But the point is, these signs are early ones. They're good signs, they're encouraging, but there's a long way to go yet before the episode is completed. In the meantime, and I think this is an important point, the environment seems likely to continue to be one in which a number of sectors of the economy are making quite strenuous efforts to contain costs and lift productivity. And there's a chart actually in the printed version of the speech that shows, I think there is some evidence now that the trend pace of productivity growth is beginning to improve again. That amounts to an outlook for wages and prices that doesn't appear likely to threaten the inflation target, even if we were to see a somewhat lower exchange rate than the one we see today. Perhaps more fundamentally, we hark on about this, but it is important, a better trend for productivity, if we can sustain it, and particularly if we can improve further the better performance we're now seeing, ought to be a reliable basis, or would be a reliable basis for optimism about the longer run prospects for our living standards and our economy. So that's where we are, and it's in that context that the board of the Reserve Bank has left the cash rate unchanged at 2.5% for almost a year now. Now, for rates to be unchanged for that long isn't unprecedented, but it is boring. Certainly, and believe me, you've got no idea how boring I can be, but markets and media commentators find this idea of masterly inaction neither appealing nor interesting or newsworthy. And so that's put more focus on communication by the bank about policy, since we're not moving the instrument. The communication has become relatively more important. So I'd like to talk a little bit about how that's evolved over the past year or so. And it has evolved given that time passes, new information comes to hand and so on. If you go back and look at the statements that we release after each meeting, you'll find that up to the time of last August meeting, August 2013, for some months, the post-board statements talked about the inflation outlook, as we assessed it at that time, providing scope, quote-unquote, to ease further, should that be appropriate to support demand. And so in the May and August meetings last year, we used that scope, some of that scope, and eased policy. From the August meeting on, we didn't have that language about scope to ease further in the statement anymore. We did have in the minutes of those meetings for some months the board's view that the bank should, and I think the words were, neither close off the possibility of reducing rates further nor signal an imminent intention to do so. And we kept that phrasing for several months right through to the end of 2013. After that, the data that we received over the summer saw somewhat firmer growth, a little bit higher inflation and with a lower exchange rate than had been embodied in the outlook as we had previously been presenting it. And that led the staff forecasts for the February meeting this year and the subsequent statement on monetary policy published just after that meeting to be revised up a bit. So growth was revised up a bit, inflation revised up a bit. The December quarter CPI in particular was something of a surprise. We interpreted those data as containing a degree of noise, but we couldn't entirely rule out the possibility that they might also contain some signal. And so that was behind that plus a slightly lower exchange rate was behind the inflation forecast being revised up a bit. Now, if you're revising up your growth and inflation forecasts, it's kind of odd to continue with language that talks about maybe you're going to ease some more. After all, we'd already eased a fair bit. It seemed to be having many of the expected sorts of effects. Inflation wasn't threatening to be too low, and if anything, was probably going to be a little higher, not alarming, but a little higher than we'd earlier thought, and there was better news on output. And so accordingly, the bank's language continued to evolve in the light of that new information. Now, although this shift in language, which really started in August last year, was quite gradual. The problem we can have at times like this is that people may tend to react by thinking that, well, if the bank's not thinking about easing, they must be thinking about tightening. But we weren't contemplating tightening. In fact, the conclusion that we'd come to was that we might be on the brink of sitting still for some time. And so that's why we adopted new language about stability in interest rates. We've got this phrase about a period of stability being likely conditional on the outlook as we assess it. And the intended effect of that was to be clear to people that we didn't think, at least, that higher interest rates were imminent. Now, that hasn't stopped people from opining about the timing of possible future increases or, for that matter, decreases. And that's okay. That's what makes a market. People have differing views. They put their views the market price is kind of the average of all those views. Overall, I think that the language has served its intended purpose. Presently, the market pricing suggests that, on average, market participants expect interest rates to be most likely unchanged for quite some time yet. If anything, the view there is that the probability, if there's a rate move anytime soon, it's more likely to be down than up. At least that was the pricing over recent days. Any increase in rates is thought by market participants, on average, to be unlikely for quite some time. Now, I think one should expect that the evolution of language will continue as more time passes, as further information comes to hand. And one thing that will be important to keep in mind through that period is that long before we think about the possibility of an increase in rates, it's probably going to be sensible for us to cease referring to the future period of stability, quote unquote, and revert to the more normal formulation about stable policy settings being appropriate. That evolution, if and when it comes, would amount to no more than a recognition that the period of stability has already been in place. In fact, it's nearly a year now, and it wasn't entirely in the future. But it wouldn't imply any particular change in the bank's views about the future course of policy. So my point is, language has evolved and it will keep evolving. It goes without saying that those who seek a full understanding of the way we're thinking should do more than just read the post-board statement, more than just read the minutes. If you're really interested, there's the whole analysis of the economy and the outlook in the S&P every 3 months, all 65, 70 pages of it. And if you want a really thorough understanding of the way we're thinking, that's imperative to cover that material. Now, another issue in which communication's been key is the exchange rate. There was a period, a fairly short period, in which we described it as, quote, uncomfortably high, unquote. It was actually declining as we were saying that, and it declined further subsequently, though we think that that was more due to changes in mood in global capital markets than to our words in particular. Now, we altered our language to reflect the fact that it had come down, and then we adjusted it again as it's retraced some of that decline. There seems to have been a very strong focus on whether that adjective uncomfortable would be put back into the post-board statement each month. Now, I actually don't think that's especially significant, that word, but I concede that many other people seem to think that it is. I guess what I'd say here is we have tried to avoid frequent large changes in language on the exchange rate, if only because it can move enough from month to month that if we're chasing it around with our language, we're going to end up chasing our tails. But just in case there's any doubt here, let me be clear again that we believe the exchange rate is very high by historical standards. There's no doubt that considerable parts of the economy still find it uncomfortable. It is applying acute pressure to cut costs, raise productivity, and change business models. And I think that financial markets and investors are underestimating the likelihood of a significant decline in the exchange rate at some point. Finally, on the question of communication, there's the question of housing prices. Now, few issues seem as capable of sharply divining opinions as this one. Some people want to use the B word, sometimes followed by calls for interest rates to be higher. Other people regard it as inconceivable and unthinkable that interest rates would ever respond to house prices. Still other people call for regulatory actions to constrain housing lending, which, by the way, so far in this episode has remained quite moderate overall. So there's a lot of views out there. Our views have been quite consistent on this, I think, and we've made 4 points, which I'll reiterate. The first is that with dwelling prices having fallen between 2010 and 2012, some recovery in itself was not that remarkable or particularly cause for concern, at least not initially. Moreover, if we think there is a need for more dwelling construction, which we do, well, an environment of declining prices for existing dwellings is probably not that conducive to higher rates of construction. If you're building things and you feel that the value of your inventory is falling as you build it, it's probably not a great incentive. So some pickup in housing prices as a result of lower interest rates was to be expected. It shows that monetary policy is working, and it's part of the normal transmission process. Of course, that argument becomes less persuasive if valuations reach new highs and keep going. So, and this is the second point, were there to be a further big run-up in prices, were we to see past increases leading to overconfident expectations of ongoing gains, well, that would be a different matter. And if that was accompanied by a return to significant increases in household leverage from already high levels, well, obviously that would be a matter for concern. That would be adding risk to the system. But, and this is the third point, so far, the amount of new borrowing does not appear overall to be imprudent. It's true that the rise in the value of loan approvals over the past year, which is about 20%, well, that's certainly significant. It is important, though, to scale the value of those approvals against the actual amount of credit outstanding. And there's a chart in the speech that does that. And what that shows is that while that rate of flow over recent months is certainly up a good way, it's clearly off its low point in 2011, it's actually not that high compared with longer-run history. In fact, it's only a little above the low points of 2008. The rate of growth of credit outstanding for housing is about 6 to 7% a year. So that's a little bit above trend nominal income growth. Really, it's hard to get on the soapbox and preach about that pace of growth too loudly so far. Nonetheless, and this is the fourth and final point, there is one area where people need to take care, and that's the investor market in Sydney. This is the main area where a large increase in borrowing has been occurring. Here, the total value of credit approvals is about 130% higher than its 2008 low point. And it's in the investor segment where there's been the main evidence of increases in lending with loan-to-value ratios which are above 80%. So here in this segment, we have two messages. We've put this before and I repeat it again. The first of these messages is that informing expectations about future prices and in deciding financing structure, investors, people generally, but particularly investors, should not assume prices always rise. They don't. Sometimes they fall. They have done a few times in the last 10 years. And the second point is that banks and other lenders need to maintain sound lending standards. Now, APRA has helpfully been reinforcing this point directly with bank boards recently and stressing the importance of having adequate and higher interest rate buffers in place for the borrowers, given the current very low level of rates in the market. The maintenance of strong standards for lending will be all the more important given the significant improvement availability of capital market funds in the securitisation market over the past year and the associated increase in competition to lend, which we're now seeing. Those things are all good, but it's important that lending standards be maintained. Some segments of the housing market do appear to be calming down lately. Prices have flattened out in several cities, and even in Sydney, the pace of increase has lessened. It remains to be seen whether that slower pace of growth in dwelling prices is temporary or more persistent. In my personal opinion, it would be good for a range of reasons if it did persist for a while. If the next couple of years saw an unremarkable performance on prices and construction levels remaining at the much higher rates that we're clearly going to see over the next 12 months, I think that would be good. That would be an outcome that would contribute to balanced growth in the economy, and it would contribute to housing more people at a reasonable cost, which is actually, after all, the main objective of housing. Overall, then, the bank hasn't seen developments in the housing market as warranting higher interest rates than the ones we've had in the circumstances that we have faced. That's not because we think that financial stability considerations ought to be ignored in the policy decision. They shouldn't be, and they haven't been. They have been given due consideration in deciding the interest rate path we've chosen. And we judge that path to have best balanced to date all the considerations that we have to take into account. Well, let me then conclude. I wonder what Giblin and his platoon might have made of a meeting like this, whether they could have imagined it. Hundreds of economists, econometricians converging on Hobart from around the country and around the world for just a few days, travelling not in steel ships and trains at a stately pace the way they would have, but in aluminium tubes through the stratosphere at just under the speed of sound. Well, they probably couldn't have imagined that. But at least some of the issues we talk about today, I think, would sound familiar to that generation. Very large swings in the terms of trade. The effects of massive international financial events with all their spillovers. Policymakers around the world grappling with things that they had not themselves experienced before. All those things come to mind. What also comes to mind, I think, is the limits to knowledge, the search for innovative solutions to new problems and so on, or in many cases, old problems. So they would have seen a need, I think, as we should, for the economics profession to make a constructive contribution to our national debate about economic matters. Hopefully, the discussions that you all have here today will, and over the course of the conference, will help us all to play our parts. With that, thank you for your attention, and I'll attempt to answer your questions. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Omar Majid from ANU. So you talked about rising prices helping construction, dwelling construction, but there was an article in Economist some time back that said Australian house prices are overvalued by about 40%, and I'm wondering, how do you reconcile the two statements?
Well, it's a not uncommon phenomenon for international observers to look at prices in Australia and think that they seem very high. My response to that usually is, firstly, you know, never say never. Never say that it's impossible that prices could go down sharply. I think that would be tempting fate. But if you look at price to income ratios, I think often these comparisons are drawn between Australia and the US. But if you look at a whole range of countries, and I had this in a speech a year or two back, It's actually the US that's the outlier on the downside in terms of price to income ratios. Now, that's no guarantee that the others are not too high, but the fact is that in terms of price to income over about 10 years, we've been up and down, cycling around, I think what seems to have been a fairly persistent higher mean for that ratio. But we are in the company of many other countries. So I think that's an important perspective to keep in mind. Certainly, I would not regard housing values in most of the mainland capitals anyway as cheap, and I think there are actually significant social issues around the level of housing values. But that's a separate question. It's really beyond my responsibility to talk about those things. But I think these international comparisons, you have to be a bit discerning in how they're used. And one day when the Economist says something good about Australia, I'll probably die of shock.
Julian Pearce, you indicated that there was nothing in the current housing market that would lead you to believe on the data available that needed to be some specific policies perhaps directed a bit more to housing than other sectors. There's always the risk that may occur in the future, and I think the supply side and the housing sector in Australia is quite constrained, so there is always the potential for some unfavourable price responses that reflect more supply side rather than demand side. I'm interested in your comments on while not relevant at the current situation, but more general comments on the appropriateness of more specific policies that perhaps directed more to housing rather than the general interest rate structure, so-called sort of macro-prudential policies that you might consider in concert with APRA.
Well, my view on macro-prudential tools is I'm quite happy for Australia to use them where that makes sense. As I said earlier, I think in the main, for most owner-occupier borrowers, I don't think we've seen imprudent borrowing in this recent period. The area where we need to watch is the investor market in Sydney. As I also said, APRA has actually been reinforcing the need for, given that interest rates are very low, probably interest rate buffers that they apply should be a bit bigger. I mean, that is a macro-prudential tool, really. It's not surrounded by all the theatre and drama and, you know, stuff that some other countries have, but it is actually a macro-prudential tool. That's what it is. So they're quietly, but I think effectively, using the tools at their disposal, very much with our encouragement and agreement, to kind of lean into the boom a little bit, and I think that's quite sensible. If it took more stringent use of such tools, well, I think they have them, and I'm sure they'd be amenable to using them if there was a macroeconomic stability need, because APRA does have a macro stability element of its mandate. My only other comment about macro-prudential tools, and this is well known, is I think they're useful. I rather fear that in some parts of the world too much will be expected of them, frankly, but I don't think that's a problem we're going to have. And I very much agree with your points about the supply side. I mean, I think that's a huge issue in housing, and in a sense, if we're too rigid on the supply side, then fundamentally housing prices have to be higher. That's not a bubble, that's fundamental. It's not good, though, because really, in a country this size and the land we have, I can't see how we shouldn't be able to have fairly inexpensive shelter, really. And I wonder whether we've unnecessarily given away a natural advantage we have. But anyhow, that's really beyond my area of expertise. And then there's one at the front here.
Paul Blackwell.
Okay. Michael Knox, Morgan's Financial. My question is about the equilibrium level of short rates and the risk premium and risk appetite. We're going through a period where official rates around the world are now much lower than and seem to be at equilibrium at much lower levels than they were before 2007. Yeah. And that may be because with all the tumult of the period in 2007, 2008, 2009, investors have lower risk appetite. They're more scared than they were. And that seems to have generated this lower level of equilibrium. Now, some people, for example, Ben Bernanke has said in passing, he thinks it'll be a long time before rates get up to the kind of equilibrium levels they were before 2007. Governor, do you have a view on this?
Well, I think I would frame this, I guess, in the VIXL world, because I tend to think that way. So we're saying the natural rate of return on capital has gone down for various reasons. That's the argument, and I think that there's likely to be some truth in that, at least in some jurisdictions. I think that's less obvious in our case, but we ourselves have said that, or some of my colleagues have said, and I'd agree that probably what we used to think of as the normal level of the nominal cash rate, probably normal in the near future anyway, is a bit lower. So I think all that's true. I'd still be hoping, though, that even the lower new normal that we might see one of these major central banks get back to that sometime in my remaining career. I hope we see that, because it's been a very long time at a very unusual low level so far.
So, at the start of this question session, you said you had a question for us.
No, I was offering to supply my own question needed, which would be something like, how come the Reserve Bank's done such a great job? Could you explain? Well, we don't need that, because there are some others here. Second...
Governor Ivan Cahoon, I was wondering when you were...
Tassie boy, yes.
I remember when you were Deputy Governor, for a time there, the Reserve Bank asked the question, could the economy afford to grow more quickly? And I wonder, the bank has been forecasting the economy growing below trend for some time. A lot of the contribution to growth has come from resource exports. So how would you respond to the question that the economy could afford to grow more quickly?
Well, I think estimates of non-mining activity, and you know, these estimates are very rough approximations, but for what they're worth, they suggest that non-mining growth has picked up somewhat. Literally speaking, it was probably about trend over the last four quarters. Be good if that continued, but I think the non-mining activity could probably grow a bit above trend for a while, because I think there's a bit of spare capacity has built up in that sector, and as we know, the mining, certainly the investment growth, has turned down. So I think the economy can grow a bit faster than we've seen over the past couple of years, and our estimate is in due course it will, but it's probably a little bit longer yet before we get the clear evidence of that. And I think I should estimate that we are fairly modest about our own ability to kind of fine-tune that and make it happen faster or better. I think we're doing a lot to help that, but you know, we're not miracle workers. So I think the policy settings are in place, as I presently estimate it, for that non-mining sector to continue to improve, but that's going to take time. When you think about part of that story being non-mining capital spending by businesses, and the evidence is starting to emerge that's starting to look better, but that's from a low base. And you can't just go turn animal spirits on. There is no lever called confidence that we can go and pull. I'm very happy to go pull it if it's there, but it isn't. Animal spirits take time to they have to be nurtured, but they take time to grow. We've got to do what we can to stop negative things happening that would counter that. But in the end, these things have to kind of grow and take their time to do so, and I'm not sure that we can, you know, kind of hurry that up all that much by certainly not by macroeconomic policies. So the answer is it can grow faster. I think in due course it will. I think we're going to have for a little while yet, though, a period of uncertainty as to just how confident we can be that that'll eventually happen. I think that's inevitable in an episode like this.
So we have time for one more.
Paul Bloxham, HSBC. On the exchange rate, Glenn, you gave a speech last year, November last year, with an expectation that the Aussie dollar would more likely go down than up. It's actually gone up a bit since then, and I wondered...
Went down first, but...
This is very true. And I wondered whether we will really need to wait until the rest of the global central banks start moving towards normality before we could expect that we get the Aussie dollar coming down a bit and helping that rebalancing speed up. Mm. I also wondered, on another separate point, which you've made in the speech today as well, that you point out that the Aussie dollar has been high and that's uncomfortable for some businesses. It's making them make adjustments to the way they operate, and in fact whether the Aussie dollar being uncomfortably high is a bit of a necessary evil, given we want stronger productivity growth in Australia.
Well, on the latter point, certainly a degree of discipline on various parts of the economy will help promote productivity growth and so on. That's good. But the right level of discipline is good. Too much or too little is not good. And I'm not aware, frankly, of any conventional metric that would take account of relative costs, relative unit costs, etc., and prospective terms of trade trends that would suggest to you that the Australian dollar should be as high as it is today. You know, maybe there's some new fundamental at work here that we haven't yet seen that warrants a higher number, but that case has to be made. And as I said earlier, I think investors in their search for yield and in the very low volatility world that we presently live in, where people think that the risk of anything going wrong seems to have completely gone away, I think that's over-optimistic. And I think part of that is an underestimation of the likelihood of the Aussie going down at some point, and possibly quite materially. On the question of whether we have to wait for the other central banks, well, in some sense, you know, there's an obvious truth to what you say. The puzzle right now, actually, in my view, is partly maybe why the Aussie's so high, but the bigger puzzle globally is why the US dollar is so low. It's patently clear, I think, that the US will be the first, that they're all, it's obvious they're going to be out of quantitative easing within a few months, and they themselves are talking about starting the interest rate adjustment next year sometime. Now, the timing of that, I suspect, will remain a bit fluid for a while yet, but it's clear roughly the way they think, and it's pretty clear that Japan and Europe are thinking in a very different way. So how come the euro is as high as it is? How come the dollar's not firmer? I think that is a conundrum. I think it's when we ask around the markets, most people seem to think that's a conundrum. Somebody must know the answer because they've been the ones doing the selling. But that is quite a big question, and it's a much bigger question than just an Australia-specific one. Anyway, that's what I want to say about exchange rates.